Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help!
All right, we are on with what will soon be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and just across the way, George P. Fraser. George, have you ever met anyone as interesting as you?
No, but I'm looking.
It's a lifelong ambition, isn't it, to meet someone as interesting as George P. Fraser?
Kind of reinforced for me.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
No, we meet interesting people all the time, don't we?
Yeah, when you lay your head on the pillow, though, at night, you go, ah, it's me again, right? I was the most interesting person I met today.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. Can't wait till tomorrow. What was that,
today,
Joe Namath? His autobiography was, I can't wait for tomorrow because I get better looking every day.
Today might change all of that, George. Today, it all might change because we're going to talk in our in-studio guest, Jack, in just a minute, and he is probably, possibly more interested than you.
He grew up in a lot nicer place than I did. I'll just say that right now.
Mm-hmm. All right, George, I want to start with a quote. I love this quote. I actually quoted it a couple of days ago. And that was from J. Vernon McGee. It says, this is God's universe and he does things his way. You may think you have a better way, but you don't have a universe.
We don't?
I'm looking at you, Georgie boy.
That's a great quote because that is the root of most of our problems. That, you know, the difference between George and God is God doesn't want to be George.
Right.
And I think he
knew George
that.
Doesn't have a universe.
No.
No.
No. It's an injustice, I'll go there. But I think that says volumes, doesn't it? And I think for most of us that are alive, our big problem is idolatry. You know, you shall have no other gods before me, and that's what we do. Anytime I choose to sin, and I do choose to sin, I'm saying that my will is more important and better than God's, and I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about step three tonight. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step three is kind of like opening a door that's still locked and closed. So step three says, let's open that door and go in.
It's an invitation.
And
we think we make the decision. And I want to go back to step two last week where we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Like all of a sudden we decided that this is what we're going to do because it's better than what we've been doing. But actually, we didn't decide that. God drew us in. And part of the decision is God speaks to us and says, there's a better way. It's me. And we take credit for that, but it's a lot doing him. The old recovery room story is there's three frogs on a log.
Mm-hmm.
One of them makes a decision to jump into the pond. How many frogs are on the log?
Three.
That's right, Bill. Congratulations.
Well, you held up three fingers.
Well, I missed it the first five times I heard it, but he only made a decision to jump in. He didn't do it.
Right.
And so part of this step is not a decision. It's implied that you actually have an action step, too.
Now, George, this step looks not only hard, but maybe even impossible to most people, because I don't care how much you try, exactly how do you turn your life and will over to the care of this God that you maybe don't know yet?
Well, that's the real hard part. We turn over parts of our life that we can't deal with anymore. So most of us look at God as plan B. And if I can't handle this, then I'll try everything I can and then give it to God.
Mm-hmm.
How do you give something to somebody that already has it?
Yeah.
God is in control of everything. And I think what we're doing now is we're going to stop fighting God and go along with him. God's will is going to happen. You can fight it or you can go along with it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's just think for a moment about the way we are so dependent on so much for everyday living. I mean, there's nothing in that we do that's that independent. And yet we fight fiercely for independence and for doing things our way. Am I helping at all?
I'm not going to argue with you.
No, I know you're not.
Are you helping? Yeah,
I think you see that very well. We live with such dependence on everything we do. And every aspect of everyday life is built on dependence on others.
Well, my next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. And one of our guests, Dennis Paul Wallen, was on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking to me afterwards. He goes, you say that all the time. do you actually believe it? Because you don't live it all the time. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, thanks, pal. But that's exactly right. It's a nice thought, but to actually walk it out is very hard.
Mm-hmm.
You got to do it every day. I think we have to choose every day whom we will serve. I believe that's in Joshua or someplace in the Old Testament. But you wake up every day where you make the decision to follow Christ. Jesus said, you got to pick up your cross and deny me or deny yourself daily. Mm-hmm. And I deny him.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I said that. It's kind of subliminal, you know. Because you wake up and you got to choose who you're going to serve today. Bob Dylan said you got to serve somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And we do. And that's the decision and the action.
Mm-hmm. All right, George, so when we think about our emotional or mental independence, which we want to have, right? When we get up in the morning, how do we decide what we're going to choose?
Well, I think you have to make a discipline. For me, every day before I get out of bed, I pray for the power, strength, and desire to stay sober today.
Mm-hmm. And after 33 years, you're still doing that.
Well, that's the only thing that worked.
Awesome. I love it.
You know, I want to make a decision before I get up to not run on George time, but try to run on God time.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to acknowledge that we can't do this, we don't want to do this, but he can do it for us. And we have to yield that command to what I think God wants me to do. And most of us are very big about getting into the Word right away because we don't want to go off on our own. But you need to practice this. You need to have discipline, and you need to recognize that God's will for us is to do his will.
Mm-hmm. When we have these, you know, we're on this tightrope every day when you're trying to run your own world and run your own life. And, of course, you're always at risk of going down. Most times it happens. So you're under this pressure, and yet we still want to get on that tightrope every day instead of saying, I need to absolutely surrender and turn this over to God. And I need to, like step three says, I need to make that decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God.
Need to do it all day long.
All day, every day.
Yep. And that's hard because we think, hey, I got this.
Why do I know?
God is extremely busy helping other people. I have this.
Right.
And we need to get into the habit. I really think the self-centeredness and self-seeking, we think about ourselves all the time. It's just almost impossible not to. And we need to discipline ourselves, Bill. You talk about the exercises we do in the 12 steps
mm-hmm.
to change our thinking and change our behavior.
Mm-hmm. And there again, I like to re-stress that it is like calisthenics. If you told me you wanted to lose 5 pounds, but you weren't willing to do certain calisthenics, well, how are you going to lose the 5 pounds? Isn't it common sense?
It is, but the thought is nice. I want to do it, but what's the action?
Right. So you get up, and we start the day with, thy will be done, not mine. Does that pretty much summarize, George, what you say to God in the morning?
Yes.
Okay.
And by the second cup of coffee, I'm always off the program.
Are you?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah. But your intentions are always good in the morning.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Do you ever wake up in a bad mood? Because I do
often.
Sometimes.
Yeah, I do.
And it's because I'm not getting what I want or I'm afraid I'm going to lose something I have. And really what this, we have to retrain our mind and our spirit. What does God want me to do?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get up, I always go to what am I looking forward to today?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like coming here tonight, I was looking forward to
all day you were excited, weren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. I love it. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, our in-studio guest, Jack. And in full disclosure, Jack is a dear, dear, dear friend of mine. I met Jack when I was 9. So we go back a long, long way.
That is a long time,
it is.
Bill.
Well, it's not that long, George.
It's a long time.
No. I'm in my late 30s. It's no big deal. All right, let's take a break. Come back with more of Real Recovery in just a minute. All right, we are back to Real Recovery. We're so glad you're with us tonight. What a fascinating show on deck. We've got my friend Jack in studio. And George, I've heard this many times before, that sometimes we have guests on the show that if they had a run-in with the law. They've been in and out of prison many times. They've taken meth, and they've done a lot of very, very serious drugs. And the stories of redemption are powerful, and I love them. But then every once in a while, we get a story, probably more like the one we're going to hear tonight, where, and I'll let Jack unfold the story, but you kind of just busy life, marriage, raising kids, busy jobs, travel, and you can kind of slip into a mode where a little alcohol would be relaxing at the end of a hard day.
Yeah, and why not start earlier than, you know, at the end of the day? I think one of the things that can happen is we can confuse blessings. And what I mean is sometimes having your world crash early is a real blessing. Conversely, having a very successful life at work and in the community, and I don't know your story, can enable us to keep doing it because we go, hey, I'm doing great.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes is not the truth.
Yeah. And so, Jack, welcome to the show.
Billy, thank you.
Yeah.
It's great to be here.
I'm just so
also
thrilled.
Also, George, it's nice to meet you.
Thank you.
So thrilled
Likewise.
To have you in studio. And I've got a picture I wish I would have brought. It's when Jack and I were on the team, the Philadelphia Flyers. We got to the finals and lost in the finals. I was devastated.
It's a great picture.
That's a great picture. Yeah, yeah.
We were 10.
Yeah, and thank you, Jeff Higgins, for getting us there.
Maybe someday we'll put it up on the website.
That'd be nice.
Okay.
And thank you, Jeff Higgins, for getting us there because he scored most of our goals.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
All right. So, Jack, I always think back of what friendships are over decades, and I feel so honored that we have that place in life where we can journey together.
We do.
And I love you, and I love your family. And so this is a thrill that you said you would come on the program and have the conversation.
Yes.
Because, like I said earlier, you're a successful person. You've got a great family, and you work hard. And then there's this opportunity, and you talk about where you can start to drift. So right. Talk about that a little bit.
So, again, thanks for having me on, mm-hmm. Bill and George. And it's an honor to be here. And I'm more than happy to tell my story. And then I'm hopeful, you know, I know we'll get into a discussion, but sin is seductive. It works quietly. And over a longer period of time, and I put alcohol in that, you know, basket of evil, but over a long period of time, over 12 to 20 years, quietly you get moved into a position where you think you have free will, you think you're bulletproof, you think every decision you make is right on, and you begin to actually quietly live in a delusion world that's probably at least one, if not two, steps away from reality. But it happens slowly, and to me, alcohol was a big part of that. And the seduction starts when you grow up in an Irish family and having drinks is a part of the family experience and it's acceptable and your mom's 100% Irish. And so it becomes a part of a lifestyle. And then, you know, quietly and seductively, you can, over a long period of time, get trapped. And that's difficult. And alcohol can come between you and relationships. It can come between you and decisions you're making. And it clearly can affect your behavior and your thinking and, you know, the way that you relate to people that you love the most, like your wife and your children. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you just a quick example. I remember one time when my daughter was about 14, and she said, you know, Dad, you're not interested in the same things I am. And that's just, it's just a perfect example that I'm not in step, I'm not in tune with what she thought was important, and I was sort of detached emotionally, mentally, spiritually, so that I couldn't relate to that. And that's just a sort of a symptomatic symptom of being sort of in your own world. And I hate to say it that way, but you become very self-centered, and a lot of the decisions you make are about and for yourself. And then, unfortunately, if you have years of promotions, and I think there were 7 in a period of 12 years, and you're in a global sales and business development role, and you find yourself in Bangkok, Thailand, when your 6-year-old breaks her front teeth across a bicycle, and you're 13 hours away, and you're distant, that doesn't help with intimacy with your children. And on the same trip, if you're playing golf in Phuket, Thailand, and there are, you know, four people that are serving you, there's one on the bag, there's one that's got the umbrella, there's one that holds the flag, there's one that is in the raking the sand trap, and you find yourself further and further away from what God wants, which is probably a great relationship with your wife, a great relationship with your children, a great relationship with the people that are in your life that you really should be close to and share your life with and not perform for. Because, you know, I mean, I can be pretty funny and I can make it about me. And it can be, you can find yourself on a stage and you can find a lot of people clapping and you can find a lot of people that want to either follow or be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're fun and you're energetic and you're in Thailand or you're in Tokyo or Sydney or Melbourne or London. In fact, Bill, remember I showed up in January of 2008 when you were in London and we were in the throes of
that was crazy.
Triple Espresso
yeah. mm-hmm.
was playing in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I show up at your theater.
Unbelievable.
And at post-theater, we get together, have a little chat, and you're like, this is killing us because no one's coming to the theater.
Mm-hmm.
We just invited the whole eighth grade class of some London middle school to come see us because nobody's coming and paying in the midst of this early recession.
Well, there was the Iraq war has just started, anti-American demonstrations in the street, and they charged a service fee to get into the city via car. So there was every reason not to come, and Broadway shows were closing around us nonstop. And we had two critics' choices in 5 weeks. A producer said, if you get one in 5 weeks, they'll be queued up around the block. We had two in 5 weeks, and business was dying. So it was crazy.
So I'm just trying to suggest that there's a lot of things that reinforce a lifestyle. And if your lifestyle includes alcohol, as well as, say, for instance, for me, business travel globally and rising in a corporation, being reinforced by bonus systems and a very motivated, successful staff that looks to you for direction. And when you find yourself in, you know, frankly, any city in the world, and you say, I think it's a great idea to go to the St. James Power Station in Singapore, and you bring your staff till 3 a.m., and you're playing dice games and absolutely, you know, sloshed with alcohol. This is just, you know, I hope you can take a step back and reevaluate whose lives you're leading, the activities that you're involved with, and what's a more, you know, a better relationship, because, you know, God wants to be in relationship, Jesus wants to be in relationship, and you're withholding real relationships from everyone you touch and everyone that you're leading. And I'll just open it with that for right now.
I was listening to him talk about playing golf in Thailand, you know, with four caddies, and then I thought of you with your little bag on your public course, and you must have felt inadequate when he was talking about that.
No, I was mentally in Thailand playing golf. I'm still back there. I didn't hear the rest of it. I think what it gets to is if we don't measure our success on God's idea of success, you can have all the worldly success, and hopefully at some point he's going to intervene and you realize how empty you are. Because it doesn't sound like anything bad here corporate-wise, and the measure for a lot of us growing up was what do you do? You know, where do you live? How much are you making? And success. 7 times in 12 years promoted. You're doing a lot of things right.
Right. You reframe in your mind what you think is what the world thinks is successful. And you really lose touch with compassion and right relationships and modeling good behavior and actually being in touch with God. And you put a lot of things between yourself and God that need to be torn away. And alcohol was one of them. And we could talk more about that specifically because I want to talk a little bit about the alcohol abuse and how that shaped my decisions and relationships and what the turning point was and how we can, you know, come back to a fruitful, free will, God-loving, you know, life.
Awesome.
A life of freedom and not a life trapped in a prison cell, a self-imposed prison cell, or what the world offers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a story that I'd like to share.
Love it.
I'm wondering, with all these promotions, when was it good enough?
Never was.
Okay.
I want to go back to, I thought Jack did an interesting way of framing something when he said, I grew up in a, you know, an Irish family. And there's a cultural element to that that we don't ever, I don't, have we talked about that on the show?
No, we consider that the master race, the Irish. And well, a lot of us get the Irish flu, which is called alcoholism today.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, the parents growing up in our house, if I wanted to ask my mom or dad if I could stay over at Larry's house and they had the cocktails out, I wait to two or three cocktails and I get a yes.
Mm-hmm.
People celebrate and they're happy. You see them do this magic thing, and all of a sudden everybody's in a good mood. And absolutely, it was a part of our being raised.
Now, I don't put this on my mother, but, you know, she liked a bourbon, and she was 100% Irish. And so she was full of life, and she was a fantastic person, and people were drawn to her. They got energy from her. She was truly interested in your life. She'd say, George, how are you? And he said, oh, I'm fine. No, George, how are you doing? Right? I mean, really wanted a response, right? And, but if you find yourself on Christmas Eve in 1986 and the family thinks it's a good idea to chug Heineken bottles to see who can chug the fastest, and your mother scores 11.26 seconds. Mm-hmm. And everyone else is struggling to get below 14 seconds, and you find out that you have four or five or six of those, and that's as a part of the Christmas Eve, and everybody thought chugging contest was a great idea. And finally, the men say, you know, Char, how did you do it? She's, you know, late 70s, and she says, well, that last little bit, you got to suck it through the neck. So you know how the Heineken bottle was tapered? She said, well, you know, you got to suck it through there. And so we all laugh, and it's great frivolity and everything, but, you know, it becomes a part of the fabric and the fabric of your life. And for Irish, it can quite easily be exhilarating. It can give you a lift. It can become a part of your fabric and a part of dinners or late nights. Pub experience is great. But I think there's an opportunity to still be a part of that, but alcohol doesn't need to be at the center of that.
Mm-hmm. All right, I have to take a break. When we come back, more with Jack in studio, my very special guest. You're listening to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. Thanks for being with us tonight. My friend Jack is in studio, and what a lively conversation we're having. George, at the break we were talking about, you said that alcohol came into the celebration because you did that when things were happy. That was your framework about alcohol.
Growing up, it was.
Yeah, it seemed like it's celebration.
Wasn't it yours for
Absolutely.
A while?
Absolutely, celebration time. Here's the reason to celebrate. Let's have alcohol around.
Even down to going out to dinner and they click glasses and, you know, here's two. And
Yeah.
It's just fabulous.
Yeah. But the way it creeps into your life, and Jack's going to share that with us now, is a fascinating look at it. So, Jack?
Yeah. So for me, since 1986, I've been in a global business, sales, and leadership position. And in 1991, you find yourself in Taipei, and Albert Lowe is playing some ridiculous game with small toothpicks, and if you can guess the number of toothpicks, you get to take a shot of some kind of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And then a week and a half later, you're in Tokyo, and there's 16 people from Sumitomo at the table, and Mr. Yamaguchi-san's the vice president. He's in the middle of the table. And alcohol is a big part of their culture. And so you start with sake, and then you'll have wine, and then you'll have beer. And then I happen to mention to Curtis Lee next to me, say, you know, have you ever had Jack Daniels? And then all of a sudden some waiter slams a Jack Daniels right next to your plate. And you're like, well, I didn't ask for one, but sure, I'll drink it. It's here now. And, you know, so I'm not saying that I'm not shifting the burden to global business development and sales. But I became swept up in a culture where it was acceptable or a part of doing business.
Mm-hmm.
And so being Irish, having a thirst, in our family, George, we called it the thirst, which just meant start at the left and go to the right. And it was just, we had the thirst. So actually it could be alcohol, could be coffee, could be water, could be today. For me, it clearly it's not alcohol, but it could be anything. But it was a proclivity to drink. And so for me, I was all over the world, had a number of successful years, and the world wanted my company's technologies and products, and it was a great thing. And so sometimes over time, when you're in that environment and in that lifestyle, it's self-fulfilling. In other words, and it's self-reinforcing. So the success begets more success. The relationships I mentioned before in Taipei or Australia, Sydney, Melbourne, anywhere in the world, it becomes a part of that lifestyle. And actually you begin to proactively bring it more and more into that lifestyle. So in a way, the alcohol is self-fulfilling, because every part of the world has a specific alcohol that is, local and great. Okay, but at some point, and this is where the story changes, people around you start to notice that you're not a part of their life anymore. So when I would come home, my wife would be distant. She would not necessarily be intimate or inclusive in the depth of the family discussions. And I became a problem. And I'll tell you why I became a problem was because she would say, when you're here, you're really not here. And that was absolutely true. And so I would be back from 12 days on the road and I would reengage with the family, but there was no cornerstone to reengage, whether it was relationship with my wife or my children. And I was blind to it. I was blind to it because there were fruits of my labor, but they were worldly fruits. And I was trapped in a whole lifestyle that was self-fulfilling because the work side was nothing but success and a lot of positive affirmation, but a lifestyle that was broken. It wasn't relational, like Christ has relation with us, or God has a relation with us, or the Holy Spirit has a relation with us, in a real relationship where it's a two-way relationship. You're not on the stage. You're not telling the jokes. You're not performing. You're invested for the right reasons because your daughter wants you interested in her activities to support her and to love her, a loving relationship, and not a broken, distant relationship. And here's where it became a problem. The problem became when I would come into the home, observe something, and try to change the rules because I was really absent and my children would behave in such a way and I'd say, you need to go study now. And Karen would say, no, Kate helps with the dishes right now and this is what we do. And then she goes off and studies and then she gets ready for bed. And so when you begin to try to reorder some of the behaviors and expected rules in the household, you get it. You get it from your wife. Your children don't quite understand it. And I'll tell you one other quick one just to tell you how distant I became. My daughter was sitting next to me, and at the time she was about 7 years old. And she was screaming, for my wife. Not screaming, but yet calling out for my wife. And I said, Kate, what do you need? And she said, I need the television channel changed. I said, well, I can help with that. She said, you can help with that? And so you get a sense for, what they thought I could do, my value in the family, and how distant and broken that was. And so when you come back, or when you're at a 50th birthday party, and there's a massively I did something massively embarrassing, and it was so uncomfortable that the family quietly began to leave. They quietly began to go home, and it was my 50th birthday celebration, and I had had a lot to drink. And I don't put it on the alcohol. I own it today. I get that. But my wife was so broken over this experience that she challenged me that night. We had a very, very long discussion for a period of at least two and a half hours, from 11 to 1:30, something like that. And it was just she and I. And she basically read me the riot act and said, you know what? I want out. I can't do this anymore. You've been a great provider, but you're not here. We're not in a relationship. There's no real love here. And I don't know what world you're living in, but it's broken. And you have a lot of problems. And did I accept it at that moment? I think I tried to defend my position, you know, that traditional defensive sort of language. But it was broken, and she wanted out. She didn't want anything to do with me. And, you know, that's a hard moment. That's a really tough moment. And it's not something where you can just suddenly get on your knees and beg for forgiveness, because there is an 8-foot ice brick wall between you and your wife, and it's broken. And I can point to her, and she can point to me, but it took us 18 months to reframe the relationship and work our way back out of it. But she had no interest, and we're together today, but she had no interest in that process. She thought it was way too far, you know, a bridge too far, that it just can't happen. Broken relationship, dry, no emotional attachment, broken. And she wanted to do what was in the best interest of her and the children, and she wanted out. And so between the 27th of October and November 10th, it took me some time to come to a realization that where am I? What's happening here? And, you know, am I prepared to make some changes? And I'll tell you the trigger, and here's the trigger, God's truth. I was at a global sales meeting. We met on Thursday, Friday, Saturday. At 4 in the morning, early Sunday morning, I was playing Guitar Hero in a penthouse with the global vice president of sales, and she was kicking my butt. And there was a lot of alcohol involved. But you find yourself in the wrong room at the wrong time, doing the wrong thing, thinking you're having, you know, same old pattern. And I went back to my room because our flight was Sunday morning, about 11 o'clock. And you wake up, and at 9 a.m., your face in a toilet vomiting. And I looked in that toilet, and I go, you know what? You have serious problems. You know, you're 50 years old. You're too old for this. This is broken. Your wife wants out. Look what you've just done physically, emotionally, mentally. You are affecting everybody that you're touching in what you thought was a very positive way, but it's broken. You're not being your best self. You're not representing God. You are broken. And I walked away from alcohol that morning. It's difficult, and I can share more about that, but that was a triggering moment. If you find yourself staring into a toilet bowl and you're on your knees and physically your body is telling you, you have to make a change. You can make a change. Children in daycare pick up a lot of toys, and they look and they see another one, and they drop it, and they toddle over, and they pick up a different toy, and they find that interesting. And in the same way, with God's help, you can drop alcohol, look for a substitute, and God will usher you through and shepherd you through. And it's not easy, but it's such a terrific promise that he makes to never leave us, to always be with us, to never give us something we can't overcome. And with God's help and grace, you can rebuild a marriage. You can create real relationships with children, with loved ones. You can make a positive contribution in work. And I want to say this with all sincerity. None of my real friends have ever abandoned me. And there's a real fear there, because they're used to you being that person that can celebrate with them and go to a wild game and have lots of drinks as a part of that lifestyle experience, but nobody gave up on me. And everybody, 10 and a half years later, is still there and is supportive and has helped me have a real life with real choices and real love and real emotions and real, more importantly, real relationships with Karen, the kids, and those that I'm in touch with. And that's sort of the story, and I can talk more about it, but that's it at the moment.
Mm. George, Jack talks about the taking off and the putting on. We've talked about that before, how important that is. You just can't take something off and not pick something else up.
Right. I think there's a couple things listening to the story, and very interesting. Thanks for being so open. It's really hard to be a business leader on an international scale or a national scale and be walking with God as your number one thing. There's a lot of temptations out there. The number one thing about business, and I'm a capitalist, it's the best system we have, is really greed. You want to make as much money as you can. That gets reinforced. You go up the level. You're out drinking. You're partying because you deserve this. You're not doing it for God, so you can give it away. Yeah. Could go on for a long time.
I know. We'll resume the conversation after the break. You're listening to Real Recovery. Thank you for being with us tonight. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. Thank you for being such a great audience, listening, caring. We got a great note from some listeners last week that really liked Dr. Tim Walsh. So we're going to have him back in May, just so you know. But tonight's story is quite personal for me because it involves my friend Jack, who I think I became friends when I was age nine. So we've known each other forever. And Jack, I want to talk about the road back from that moment of reality where you're in a hotel room, I think in Tokyo, vomiting, to that next couple of years.
So it's just a quick one, but it's really interesting that the world can be seductive and your own pride gets reinforced and your ego can get reinforced, and this whole alcohol success lifestyle is a really self-reinforcing pattern. And in that toilet bowl and with my wife's, you know, encouragement,
mm-hmm.
I was able to have a moment of self-reflection where just said, need a change. And but that during the next 2 to 2.5 years, you need a lot of things to come back together to be successful in what I'll call lifestyle change in this reinforced pattern, which is just, it's killing you. So I want to say that God was first, because my thinking was, you know, I'm not right with God. How can I be right with my wife? How can I be right with my children? And I thought about, what are the things that I'm worshiping between myself and God, and what needs to be torn away? And alcohol was probably an easy one. And I don't mean that it's easy, but I'm saying it was so clear to me that alcohol was between God and myself. And it was really important to tear that away and to find a way to tear it away. And that would allow me to have a relationship with God and show God that I was willing to have some level of sacrifice and that there was some determination to change, turn my life around. And this is also what Karen wanted. She wanted to be in real relationship with me, and that's what she was, you know, reaching out and crying out for, the intimacy and for real relationship. And if you are worshiping alcohol or anything else between yourself and God, or yourself and your wife or your children, you have to tear it away, and that enables a real relationship. So some awareness that you need help, because when you are riding high, it's all about you, and it's an internal motivation. And when you're going to get back into real relationships with God or with your wife or the kids, it is, you got to reach out. You got to reach out. You got to ask for help. And I remember, Bill, one time, right in the middle of it, in this first year, you and I had a breakfast together, and I reached out to you, and I told you that Karen had read me the Riot Act, and that this marriage was broken. And you told me, hey, what would you think about visiting with Glenn? And would you and Karen be willing to go to that, go to visit with Glenn, who's a pro, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Karen was willing to go to that. Thank God. I mean, she was willing to go to that. But we had already been to two before we got to Glenn. We'd been to two other marriage counselors, one at a church and one through a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, you were there for me. You got us on the track. Karen connected with Glenn. I connected with Glenn. And so we reached out. In the same way, I reached out to my friend Paul, and I said, look, you're not going to believe this, but my marriage is broken. Karen wants out. And Paul says, John, you know, you just are going to retool. God's going to come around you and help you retool. And he goes, Karen will come back. You just got to kind of really, you know, be there for a long time. And this other friend of mine, Alpha, he was a great friend. And I reached out to Alpha and I said, yeah, Karen's wants out of the marriage. And he goes, John, you got to stay in there, you know. And so you find out that if you reach out, people are more than happy to reach in and to help you reframe your life and your mind and your thinking and the choices you make, and praise God, right? But it's, for me, it started with God, and to recognize that alcohol needed to be torn away so that I could enter a real relationship with God, and at the same time, show Karen progress and show her that I was really willing to make some changes and to be honest with myself and reach out to you and Alpha and Paul and people that love me and say, hey, I need help. And you didn't have all the answers, Bill, nor did Paul, nor did Alpha. But little by little, we started to chip away and make progress. And the biggest thing that Glenn helped Karen and I come through, and there was this 8-foot ice wall. But the idea that real relationships are 50-50, that we've each got an accountability, that it's not pointing at one or the other, but together, you can find love and you can find a relationship with God and you can find a relationship with each other that includes God, so that you've got, you know, God involved in a right relationship, and he blesses that.
Mm-hmm.
But it took us probably two and a half years down this path of reframing and changing and trying to understand if we can get back to a good relationship. Because when we got married in 1983, we did have a good relationship. And then I got kind of swept up and lost in the wilderness. And I created my own prison cell. I got involved in my own gerbil wheel, and I just went harder and harder and harder. And it was just fruitless from fruits of the Spirit. But God's promise is strong, and he will bring you through. And he helps put things in right perspective and helps reorder your thinking so that you can think towards relationships like with God, with your wife, with the kids. And God brought the right resources to me and to Karen and our family so that we could have a family again and that we could get into still have free will but make better choices and to think things through together and not on this the gerbil wheel of success that just is unbelievable in its seduction and in its pain.
Mm-hmm.
But through brokenness and with God, and Karen and I have been able to work through. And so 10 and a half years later, I say I wake up in the morning feeling great every day. I just do.
Mm-hmm.
I wake up feeling great every morning. I can always drive. I can drive my friends around. And I'm free to think. I have what's known as liberty, you know, thinking and actions. My thinking and actions, which I hope please God and are consistent with God's, you know, plan,
mm-hmm.
will be true and in a right relationship with liberty that allows me to think and act in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 and a half years later, very thankful that God held my hand and walked me through that whole process.
Now, your beautiful wife, Karen, offered grace and compassion. Talk about the patience element to this situation.
Yeah, so there was...
Patience was required, because it doesn't change overnight, does it?
No, patience was required, but the relationship was broken. So there was no patience to or belief that I could change.
Okay.
There was no evidence that I could change. And so patience is important, but it wasn't gifted to me until I showed real interest, real behavior, real thinking, real change that gave her confidence that I was in it, mm-hmm. that I was willing to do it, and we could have something together. And patience was, her patience was earned through action, but it wasn't instantaneous because the trust was gone. And you don't have a lot of trust. You don't have a lot of patience when you don't trust your partner.
Mm-hmm.
But it can change. And I'm here to say that she trusts me, you know, with everything in our life right now.
Awesome.
Good story, Bill.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Well, I especially love it. So you're looking at the wrong guy if you're looking for...
I do that every week. I look at the wrong guy. Yeah. But we got 7 years out of it. So no, and I appreciate your vulnerability on it. It, you know, I get back to Bill, the scripture about you can gain the whole world and lose your own soul. Mm-hmm. And I'm I'm glad that God intervened through your wife and other people because, you know, on the world's, you know, standards, he's doing great.
Definitely.
And that can be reinforcing. And I'm glad that God touched your heart enough to where you didn't say, hey, you don't like this. I'm doing great. A lot of people think I'm doing great. God brought you back to your senses.
Mm-hmm.
Great story.
And I love that when you're in a place of need, you reached out because I remember going out for breakfast. And if I recall correctly, I think I did pay. no, I do. I think I paid.
I'm sure you did. And I had nothing.
Oh, you ate something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But there was a willingness to reach out and to say, I need help.
It was at the Lincoln Dell in Sales Park.
It was.
So they're gone, but
I know.
Now it's that, but that was real.
I'm sure I had the French toast. But when you reach out and say, I need help, a lot of people say, I can't do that because, A, I can't. I don't want to make myself vulnerable.
You got to.
You have to.
That's the road back.
Yeah.
The road back. You got to do it.
Yeah.
So the good story is I was affected in reduction in force. So my job as a vice president of global sales and business leadership was ripped away from me as well. And that was in the big recession of 2008 and 9. And that job was ripped away. Now, I've had the opportunity. God brought me to another place. And I've been with the company for 8.5 years, and I'm in a phenomenal place.
And if
that big job wasn't ripped out, it's over, right? I mean,
yeah.
So my life's changed dramatically. And so the question is, what's God's will for you? And I'm here to say it can be great. You got to just trust and have faith.
And I'm giving you the final word. That's a good message. I want to thank Jack for coming into the studio. My dear, dear friend, since I've been age 9, what a story. George, thank you so much for another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. We'll build another trophy shelf with the trophies. All right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. Good night and have a great week. I'll see you next week.
His hand fell behind her as his arm had reached around. Oh, and she looked at the window and she watched the shade go down. It was a private conversation. No one heard her say.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.